Join the Career Pro community and unlock a world of exclusive insights on Career. As a Career Pro member, you gain access to articles, expert analyses, and comprehensive reports that keep you ahead on Korean affairs. Plus, enjoy priority invites to our unique events in Seoul that connect you with key leaders and influencers. Elevate your understanding of Korea. Join us today at careerpro.org/podcast. And welcome to the NK News podcast. And this pre-interview chat was recorded on Tuesday, the 26th of March, 2024. Joining me via Zoom, I have Colin Zwirko from NK News and NK Pro. Colin, welcome back on the show.
Hey, how's it going, Jacko?
Not too badly at all, thank you. And we've got a couple of themes that you have pre-selected for me to talk about. Let's start with Kim Jong-un's many military activities lately. He's been on a tank. He's observed some things. What's he been up to?
Yeah, so the North Korean leader has really done a lot more military-related or military drills-related activities in the last month, in March, compared to in previous years, where such activities were kind of sporadic or rare, other than going to missile tests. And even that kind of went down during the pandemic. So this is all about, he's gone to 7 activities in March, which were either military drills or weapons tests.
And there's still a few days of March left, so he may even sneak in another one before the end of the month.
Yeah, I think so. There were a few of them were directly related to South Korea, and they coincided with the U.S. ROK Big Freedom Shield joint drills this month.
Yep.
They were practicing taking over a South Korean guard post at the border. They were practicing dropping in paratroopers in an infiltration drill. They were practicing artillery shelling of Seoul. And then they did some missile tests, which showed 6 missiles launching at the same time. And these were supposedly nuclear-capable missiles. So they're trying to demonstrate their ability. And I think Kim Jong-un said something really interesting. You know, all the headlines these days are usually North Korea says preparing for war. And yeah, these statements are in the North Korean reports. And Kim Jong-un says we have to better prepare for war. But if you really think about it and you don't try to be so, you know, clickbaity or catchy, that this is the exact same thing the U.S. says. It's the exact same thing most countries say.
Mm-hmm.
And North Korea says this should be in a contingency. And then Kim Jong-un says straight out, I want to convince South Korea and the U.S. that I have perfect attack capability and thus prevent war and prevent any mishaps. So take of that what you will.
Okay. All right. So it may be just preventative, like that the old saying from the Latin, which I won't try to quote, that if you want peace, prepare for war.
Yeah, basically. I mean, you have to take it like that unless there's a sign of something more sinister. And I don't think we've seen that other than all of this talk about interpreting their words in reports with the whole, mm-hmm. you know, they've made a decision to go to war thing, which got big at the beginning of this year.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're not seeing anything like mass movements of troops towards the demilitarized zone, for example.
No, but there was something interesting that I found in satellite imagery, which was that they're making these 4 warships, which aren't exactly advanced by global standards, but mm-hmm. they're the most advanced warships, corvettes that North Korea has. They've been building them for a decade, and they've just sent one down to the one that Kim Jong-un inspected last year. They've sent that down to the East Coast, Kumgang area, right at the border with South Korea. And we've spotted it out in the waters east of the coast, right up north from the inter-Korean border. So we don't really know what it's doing. It might be just patrolling, like it, you know, that's its role. It's a patrol ship. Or it might be participating in drills, but that's, you know, basically the only thing that we're seeing in terms of near border stuff. And they did that artillery drill early this month up the coast, not near the border.
Right.
As far as I know, the U.S. and South Korea also didn't do their drills right up near the border. So they avoided some problems there.
Okay, wow. And that's something that you're able to pick up from satellite imagery is when there's a large enough ship near the maritime border.
Yeah,
thank you for being our eye in the sky there, Colin.
Yeah, even though it's kind of low resolution, or it's like, it's not high resolution imagery, but when it's a ship by itself in the sea, you can measure it and have a a decent idea, you know, checking where it usually is and if it's not there, and mm-hmm. you see something of a similar size out, yeah, you can kind of track these things.
Okay, now why is, moving on to another topic, why is North Korea still running its giant COVID import center?
Yeah, this is a curious case, and it's like, so there's an airport right up at the border with China in the northwest on the North Korean side that used to host some old bombers. It was like a mixed civilian military airport, I think it's 2.5 kilometer long runway. And in 2021,
just outside Sinniju?
Yeah, just outside Sinniju.
Okay.
Across from Dandong. And in 2021, they converted this into a processing center for imports.
Right.
And it appears, so they built these train stations, trains would come in, drop off cargo, they'd go through these 100 meter warehouses and then stick them outside on this giant runway for weeks at a time, sometimes 3 months. This was like mm-hmm. a quarantine because North Korea believed that the virus could stick on objects and transfer the coronavirus.
Yeah. Well, that was something that the World Health Organization, I think, lended some credence to early on in the pandemic, but then later on changed its stance on that.
Yeah, exactly. So they're still using this facility, and it's kind of strange because in the last few months, they're allowing people into the country without any virus tests. They're not required to quarantine. There were some times last year where people were let into the country for the first time into North Korea, and we learned that they weren't put into quarantine, but anyone interacting with them in North Korea, we learned at least in one case, the Russians who interacted with them were required to quarantine in their embassy after the visitors left. So there was like a bubble situation going on. But now there's no evidence of there being these bubbles. People are coming and going in and out of the country. It shows that they're not afraid of a virus outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're still funneling imports and creating a bottleneck at this facility on the border. And it's curious. So you ask yourself why. If they don't care about the virus on people, why would they care about the virus with far less chance of spreading on objects, imports?
Yes.
And so it's either just, you know, a conundrum, you know, maybe just different departments are doing different things and they just haven't changed the policy yet and they're still putting them through quarantine. Or maybe this is good for Kim Jong-un. He wants to keep funneling imports. They've increased fencing all along the border, so that stops a lot of the smuggling. And then maybe they can just better control the imports by putting them through one big facility, checking them really carefully, and then sending them on for distribution in North Korea. And this might be why. And it might mean that they're going to keep using this for years, but we'll keep our eye on it.
Could they be looking for ideological contaminants?
Yeah, that would be one thing for sure. I mean, other things like, you know, just business in general, smuggling that is evading whatever taxes and that kind of thing. But yeah, for sure, it would be the ideological material that Kim Jong-un sees as a threat. And so this disrupts trade, it makes it slower, and we'll have to see if it keeps going, because that would be a big permanent change from COVID that we've kind of been expecting, along with the fencing. That's another thing that they changed during COVID, and that looks like it's going to stay.
Now, in a country with a high volume of international trade, like South Korea or the United States, it's really not realistic to inspect every container, every shipment coming in from overseas. So they tend to do a random inspection, you know, or one per every 100 or something like that. But is it feasible that North Korea might actually be looking in every container that comes in across the border from China because the levels of trade are not that high?
It definitely seems feasible just given the physical situation. The fact that they're not opening up a bunch of different border checkpoints, you know, who knows if that's down to just they have nothing to trade. Maybe there's not, you know, economic situation prevents it. But basically, it looks like they're funneling it through this facility. And then another couple on the Far East Coast.
Okay.
It would seem that, yeah, they could, because they're bringing them through on these trains. They're putting them through these warehouses. Then they come out on the runway. I don't see why they wouldn't have the ability to check every single one of these.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting to see whether if they keep that up in the long term. Now, speaking of trade, I understand that Russia-North Korea maritime shipping has restarted after a pause of 1 month. Tell us about the pause and then tell us about the restart.
Yeah, so this was an operation that the U.S. accused the two countries of starting with a press release and a press conference last October. We found in satellite imagery that they started trading. Russian ships would start picking up containers up at the northeast Rason port back in August last year. And this was an abnormal type of trade for the two countries. They hadn't been doing it in previous years. And the U.S. says it was full of weapons for use by Russia in its war against Ukraine. And okay. So the ships have been coming and going, picking up containers, thousands of containers since last August. They were initially going to a Russian naval port, so that really raised the suspicions that this wasn't just normal trade. It was in something sensitive like weapons. We don't know exactly what's in these containers, but that kind of circumstantial evidence helped us in the open source toward what the U.S. was claiming. So yeah, these ships stopped going to Rason to pick up containers in February. And then after 1 month of no ships coming in, they finally started again earlier this month. And so it's been cloudy. We don't have full satellite imagery coverage in the last couple of weeks. So we don't know how many trips they've made, but at least it shows that the weapons trade seems to be on the rise again after a little bit of a pause, even though it might have been going still through the rail line overland cross-border port in the interim. We don't know.
Now, are we able to see from ships whether there are things coming in from Russia to North Korea, or if they're just coming in empty to pick up shipments from North Korea to Russia?
I don't know if they're empty. They're definitely bringing in containers and dropping them off.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is, it seemed like the ship that just came back in March had a deck full of containers while it was anchored east of Vladivostok out in open waters for about a month. And then it seemed to go straight to North Korea from there, even though we can't confirm if it stopped somewhere else. So that might suggest that they're empty containers and not full of something sensitive. And also, whenever they, in February, whenever the last ships dropped off containers at one pier, those containers appeared to not really move for a couple of weeks or a few weeks. Okay. And that would also suggest maybe they don't contain anything sensitive.
Mm.
Those are kind of the only hints we have. There might be some way to, well, the ships aren't broadcasting. If they were broadcasting, you might be able to, their location, identity information, you might be able to tell by their speed, or there might be ways to determine how full their load is. But no, those are kind of the only clues we have at the moment.
Okay. Now, I know last year, of course, there were a lot of meetings between Russian defense officials and senior members of the North Korean government. Have you seen any signs in the recent North Korean exercises that they're using or testing any new equipment that they might have got from Russia?
No, there's nothing. There's nothing that would, there's no evidence to say. I you can always speculate, oh, they have a new capability, or, you know, they're launching six missiles at a time. That was another interesting case. They talked about their ability to, the command and control operation ability to like press a button and have them all launch simultaneously. That's something that they would want to, that's very technical. But then they told us, by the fact that we can see where they did this missile test, and then we can check it in satellite imagery, which is what we did, that this is a purpose-built launch pad. So this was for the Salvo missile test earlier this month.
Right.
So it wasn't such a natural situation. Anyway, that's a tangent. But no, I haven't seen anything else that would suggest they've received something from Russia yet. But this all could be going on behind the scenes. This could be research. This could be development inside buildings somewhere. And we just have no ability to know yet. I think it was interesting because last year, whenever Choe Sun-hee went to Russia to have some high-level meetings, I think with her counterpart, Lavrov, we saw on a piece of paper in her hand, or maybe her assistant's hand, I forgot, but it said that it had a list of Russian space facilities to visit, quote unquote, or something like that. So there was probably definitely a team that went in from North Korea to inspect a bunch of Russian space facilities last year. So I think the cooperation is ongoing for sure. We just don't know exactly what they're doing. There was also this strange flight earlier this month where a Russian cargo plane, military affiliated cargo plane, went from Shanghai, took a weird detour straight over to Pyongyang, disappeared for 2 hours, and then flew to Tianjin, and then I think, or somewhere in China, and then on to Moscow. So there's a
disappeared for 2 hours.
Yeah, it went. It took a straight right detour to Pyongyang. Went off, didn't broadcast for 2 hours, but
they shut off their transponder.
It decreased its altitude, so it's pretty clear that it landed in Pyongyang for about 2 hours and then took off and went. Yeah, so very strange stuff, but we don't know what they did.
Hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much for updating us there on those stories, Colin.
Yeah, you can find all those stories in our, you can find more details if you search those stories. Yeah.
That's right. Always go to nknews.org to check out all of these stories in more detail. And if you see Colin's name on the website, you can click on his name and that'll bring you to the author page that bring up all the most recent articles that Colin's written. Stay tuned because after this break, I've got an interview with Jeff White about the latest in hacking and cyber theft involving North Koreans. Thank you very much, Colin. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Jacob.
In the intricate world of Korean affairs, tailored intelligence makes all the difference. Korea Risk Group's consulting services offer specialized, actionable intelligence designed to guide your career-related decisions. We provide bespoke consulting services that cater to your unique challenges and goals. From policy analysis to market entry strategies, we bring clarity to complexity. Transform uncertainty into opportunity and visit KoreaPro.com solutions today.
And welcome back to the NK News podcast. I am joined here today via Zoom by author, speaker, investigative journalist, and podcast creator Jeff White. Welcome back on the show. You were last on the show in May 2022, so it's almost been 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then we talked about your previous book, The Lazarus Heist, From Hollywood to High Finance, Inside North Korea's Global Cyber War, and also your highly successful BBC podcast that you did together with Gene Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're on to talk about your new book called Rinsed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a direct sequel to The Lazarus Heist, or are you sort of broadening your focus? Because it's not just North Korea that's in this book, is it?
Exactly, yeah. It goes way beyond North Korea. What was interesting was looking at the North Korean government hackers and the allegations against them, which sort of formed the basis of the, as I said, The Lazarus Heist podcast with Gene and the book afterwards. I sort of had this realization that I think I'd got the wrong idea about computer hackers for quite a lot of the time I've been covering them. I had this idea, which I think a lot of people do, that computer hackers have sort of godlike abilities to break into your bank account and then spirit your money away. And with a few lines of code, the whole job is done. And actually, it's perhaps predictably a lot more complicated and subtle than that. Yes, computer hackers like the Lazarus Group, the alleged elite hacking group working for North Korea, hackers are very good at breaking into places, very, very good at breaking into bank accounts, people's bank accounts, companies' bank accounts. Sometimes the banks themselves, which is what happened, of course, famously with Bangladesh Bank back in 2016. But once they actually get to the money, once they get their hands, if you like, digitally on the money, they're not necessarily that good at working out what to do with it. Where do I put this money? How do I take it away? How do I extract it? Which is, of course, laundering the money. Yep. And for that, the computer hackers are reliant on a whole bunch of other criminals who, although they're technologically savvy, like computer hackers, they're tech savvy in a different way. They understand how bank accounts work. They understand how international finance transfers work. They understand how cryptocurrency works. And so you get this sort of symbiotic relationship between so computer hackers and money launderers. But those launderers, they're not just working with computer hackers. They'll work with anybody who's got money from a criminal enterprise. So drug dealers, prostitution rings, fraudsters, all that criminal money is washing through the same conduits. And what's been interesting in the North Korea example is they're using similar laundering techniques. They're reaching out to criminals on the internet and saying, look, we've got money. Can you help us extract it and launder it?
Right. Okay. So that explains the title, Rinsed, then. So it's all focusing on the money launderers, those who make stolen money able to be used elsewhere without governments and law enforcement tracking it.
Precisely. So it's a very, very good summary. I should have hired you to do our copyright.
Now, you've got 11 chapters in the book. You've kindly let me read the two chapters that are relevant to this podcast because they focus on things that are related to North Korean hackers and cyber crimes. The two chapters are full of interesting characters. Start off by telling us who are Hush Puppy and Big Boss and how did they get involved with North Korea?
Yeah, Hush Puppy and Big Boss will be, I suspect, known to people who've listened particularly to series two of the podcast and also people who've read the book of The Lazarus Heist. What happens is this, North Korea's hackers are accused of, as I say, breaking into banks around the world. One of the banks they break into is a big bank in India called Cosmos Cooperative Bank. It starts out as a cooperative bank. It's what we call in the UK maybe a credit union. It starts out as a cooperative facility. But it emerges into a bank like any other, sitting on millions and millions of dollars worth of customers' deposits. Back in 2018, hackers suspected of working for the Lazarus Group, the North Korean elite hacking group, break into Cosmos Bank. They managed to fool the bank's computer systems into allowing them access to the ATM software. And what that means is the hackers can do what's called jackpotting, which is where you trigger cash points around the world to effectively spew out banknotes. Absolutely amazing attack. This took place, by the way, in 29 different countries around the world in a, in a space of something like 2 hours, 13 minutes. It was an astonishing sort of flash mob of ATM crime. But of course, it's all very well breaking into the bank, but how do you then get people sitting next to the cash points when the jackpotting happens, when the money's spewing out? Yes. That goes back to my point of the fact that the hackers are very good at breaking in. They absolutely understand how to get into Cosmos Bank, how to hack the ATM system. But the next challenge is, okay, well, who's going to withdraw the money for us? You have to have people who go to the ATMs with Cosmos Bank cards, or at least cloned Cosmos Bank cards, and make the withdrawals. And this is exactly what happened. So $11 million gets withdrawn within that 2 hour time window. So the next question for hackers like the North Koreans, like the Lazarus Group, is, well, where are we going to get these accomplices who can help us with that stage of the operation? So they go to the dark web and they find a chap called Big Boss, because obviously nobody wants to work with Little Boss. You, if you're going to call yourself Boss, you would call yourself Big Boss on the dark web.
And there's never a medium-sized boss either.
No, 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 you don't. You want to go to the top, the Big Boss thing. Actually, when we made the podcast, we worked with a US security company called Intel 471 to try and sort of get some details of Big Boss's dark web persona. You know, we tried to get his posts and his persona and what he was saying on the dark web to get a sense of who he was and how he was portraying himself on the dark web. Intel 471 hilariously came back to us and said, there's a lot of Big Bosses on the dark web. Can you narrow it down?
Yeah.
We did finally manage to get some information about him. But Big Boss helps out with this. He can clone cards, so he can use the create the cloned cards that are going to be used in the ATMs. He can also, he also has a network of people who he pays to go out to the ATMs to make the withdrawals, to actually withdraw the money. So basically the hackers, if you like, are breaking into the bank on one side of the picture. But when the money's spewing out, it's Big Boss and his accomplices who are withdrawing the money. So that goes very well. Big Boss would have got a take of that money, of the 11 million. I don't know how much, but you know, sizable chunk. The hackers then, the North Korean hackers are accused of breaking into Bank of Valletta in 2019, a bank in Malta in the Mediterranean. Yeah. They steal something like 13 million euros from Bank of Valletta. Now, in this case, they don't do the ATM trick anymore. What they're doing this time is simply
is that
transfer...
the kind of a trick that you can really only pull off once, that kind of spewing out $16.3 million and 12,000 withdrawals over the 2 hours and 30 minutes? I hope that banks got onto that trick after the first time and made sure it couldn't happen again.
Well depressingly, no. These jackpot attacks have been happening. And look, once you're into a bank and once you've got access to its ATM software, it's kind of game over. You can perpetrate these attacks. However, you're right. The jackpotting attacks, certainly by the North Koreans, did decline because the police started to find out about them. And the reason the police found out about them will come on to as part of the story.
Yes.
Because what happens next is the Bank of Valletta hack. They don't do the ATM software thing anymore because it's not working, because police are finding out about it. So they switch track and instead they do a SWIFT hack, which, again, listeners to the podcast, readers of the book will know. SWIFT is the interbank transfer system. Transfers money between banks. So they're going to transfer money out.
This is the same, similar method that was used in the Bangladesh, Bank of Bangladesh heist? That was through SWIFT too, wasn't it?
Same software, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
So Bank of Valletta, like the Bank of Bangladesh, has got SWIFT software installed, and that's the software Bank of Valletta uses to transfer money out.
Right.
The hackers break into Bank of Valletta, same MO as Bank of Bangladesh. They manage to navigate to the SWIFT software, and they're going to make some transfers out. Now, you remember in the Bangladesh Bank case, they had real trouble because they were trying to send the money from the New York Fed, and the transactions failed, and it ended up in the Philippines, and they had to launder it through casinos. Big headache. And again, that goes back to this laundering picture. The North Koreans broke into Bangladesh Bank, is the accusation, but when it came to getting the money out, they really struggled because they didn't have the laundering bit lined up. So you can tell they've learned from this. So the Bank of Valletta job, they're like, okay, we need a bank account into which to transfer this stolen money that's lined up and that is all ready to go, so that we can put it into that bank account and then spirit it out to our other bank accounts. For this, they go back to Big Boss, because obviously he's helping them, and say, look, did you have a bank account we can use? Now, Big Boss doesn't, but he knows a man who does, a guy who goes on the dark web by Hush Puppy.
Uh-huh.
So he starts working with Hush Puppy. Hush Puppy has got contacts in banks, particularly Eastern Europe, that can either create accounts or manipulate accounts that money can be transferred into. I mean, you're talking about millions of euros here. It's a big amount of money. Hush Puppy's got these accounts and can get money into those accounts and wash it and send it back to the hackers. So that's where Hush Puppy comes into it. So Hush Puppy and Big Boss do this job on Banco Valletta. They do get successfully about $13 million out, 13 million euros rather. Banco Valletta manages to claw back a lot of that money, but it's all going pretty well for the sort of Lazarus Group, Big Boss, Hush Puppy kind of criminal triangle.
Yeah, so to reiterate for our listeners, so the if I understand correctly, the, both the Cosmos Cooperative Bank in India heist and the Bank of Valletta heist in Malta, these were done to order by the North Koreans?
That is certainly the accusation, yeah.
Okay.
When security investigators looked into the fingerprints, the traces behind this, the email addresses used, the IP addresses used, the types of malware, the computer viruses used, the links went back to the Lazarus Group, which is suspected of working on behalf of the North Korean government. As well, your listeners will know, getting money, particularly hard currency, at its disposal is something that's a key objective for North Korea. And so this is the accusation, is it's government hackers. We call them the Lazarus Group. That's not the name they would give themselves. They're a military unit within the North Korean establishment, are tasked with going out and actually hacking into banks, hacking into financial institutions, stealing money, and that money being used to prop up the regime.
Right. So Big Boss and Hush Puppy then are two non-members of the Lazarus Group. I mean, Big Boss is American, Canadian, dual citizen living in Canada. And Hush Puppy is he originally from Nigeria, but living in Dubai?
Originally Nigerian and from Dubai, yeah. So through right. Bank of Valletta job, the Secret Service in the US managed to get a fantastic lead, which we talk about in the book. It's an amazing coincidental discovery they make, which leads them to who Big Boss is. He's a guy called, as you say, Galeb Alamari is his name, and lives, he's a joint US-Canadian citizen. He's basically on the dark web advertising his services. He didn't know when he first got involved with this that he was actually working with the North Koreans, but the Secret Service are pretty sure that at a certain point in the story, he realizes that he's working with the North Koreans.
Hush right, Puppy, his contact only uses the name Sweet, but it's supposedly a North Korean fellow by the name of Kim Il.
That's correct, yeah. So when the hackers reach out to Big Boss and Hush Puppy to help them with the laundering, they're reaching out under this pseudonym, Sweet. So as far as Big Boss is concerned and Hush Puppy, they're communicating with Sweet. It
right.
later emerges that they later realize that they're working with somebody who's in a sanctioned country, and let's face it, there's not many of those. It's probably North Korea. So they suss out that it's North Korea.
But they never actually meet in person, do they? Or do they?
Well, not officially. Huh. Folks in the Secret Service that I've spoken to believe, and this is a fascinating wrinkle that I'd love to do more investigation on, I'm still trying to pin down. Secret Service believe that at some stage, Sweet, aka Kim Il, this suspected North Korean hacker, goes to Dubai, where Hush Puppy is living the life of Riley, by the way, as an Instagram influencer, goes to Dubai, parties with Hush Puppy, and is actually in Dubai. And that's how Sweet and Hush Puppy meet and then get Big Boss involved later on. Now, that's interesting because we do know that North Korea is reaching out to countries, particularly the Middle East and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates would be one of the countries they'd probably pitch up in.
Yeah.
If Kim Il is going over there, and if he is, as the phrase went, partying on boats with Hush Puppy, that's a huge amount, as you know, that's a huge amount of liberty for a North Korean to be given.
Well, it is.
Yeah. Implies that Kim Il, aka Sweet, is a senior member of the hacking team, is given a lot of liberty. But like I say, this is all coming out information. It's all emerging right. information. I haven't sort of substantiated that. The other thing that we know
something
about...
that I'm really intrigued by is that North Korea is it's very security conscious. It's notoriously untrusting of foreigners. Some might use the word paranoid. And I wonder how Sweet was able to vet these guys to make sure that Hush Puppy and Big Boss, that they're reliable, that they won't in turn betray him for their own profit. That's got to be such a risk to take, right? To trust these guys.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. So this comes down to how you trust people who are innately untrustworthy, i.e. criminals on the dark web. Most dark web activity takes place between people who've never met and never will meet. And so how do you get trust going? Big Boss had been around for a while at this point. He'd been involved in various other hacks. Now, if he had taken the decision, as you suggest, to rip people off, to take their money and not to go through with it, that works once, but your reputation is then burned. You can't pop up with the same identity and expect people to trust you. You can pop up with a different identity, but if you keep changing your identities so you can rip people off, you never get a reputation, never build your reputation. So actually, it's in Big Boss's interest to work with people to do right by them, including, it's alleged, the North Koreans. Again, Hush Puppy, working with Hush Puppy, if he and Big Boss rip each other off, that's the end of the relationship and you're not going to make any more money. So there's a sort of long-term business strategy approach to this, weirdly. And it's a lot harder to do, actually, on the dark web than it is legitimately. So for yourself, Zacho, people can look you up online. They can see your LinkedIn profile and all of your history. You know, you're able to put a lot of stuff out there in the public domain legitimately to show people your reputation. It's good. You can't do that on the dark web. You can't say, well, I'm Jeff White and I live, you know, in North London. You can't do that. So you've got to somehow get trust, but without actually revealing much about yourself. It's quite a hard challenge. And Big Boss did a lot of work on this. You know, he really cemented his reputation. So yes, the North Koreans go, but they're not just getting anybody off the dark web. They're looking for people who really know their stuff, know their onions, have been around for a while. And like I say, after that Cosmos Bank job, you know, Big Boss could be trusted. He delivered. He did the job. He got people out in the street doing it. So again, the North Koreans the next time can work with people. I just want to come back to this character, Kim Il, who's a really fascinating character. He came up in one of the US government indictments against suspected Lazarus Group members. One of the stories in that we didn't manage to get into the podcast, got a little bit into the book, but I'm still absolutely obsessed with, is this Marine Chain story, which is that Kim Il, a suspected North Korean government hacker, is accused of creating what was effectively a sort of Bitcoin marine shipping kind of enterprise. The idea was people could invest in shipping, but through the medium of cryptocurrency. So it's the idea of it would combine all the hype of cryptocurrency with all of the money involved in big shipping enterprises. And Kim Il actually went out and recruited people for this, recruited PR people, security people. And he had this plan. They were going to raise, I think, 20 million in investment for this. They had a PowerPoint presentation. Wow. Kim Il went under a different name. The name escapes me for the moment. He went under a pseudonym. So obviously he wasn't saying he was Kim Il, John Smith or whatever. Right. So he recruited all these people. And then they would get on Zoom calls. And this John Smith character, curiously, he'd always be away somewhere else traveling. His webcam didn't work. His Wi-Fi wasn't working. So nobody ever saw him on screen. But they heard his voice and they heard him pitching this whole thing. And what's amazing is, if this is true, it was a North Korean government hacker who was doing all of this. If so, I mean, this guy Kim Il, he's in his 20s. The idea that he created this entire edifice of this fake company and was potentially raising millions, it didn't work out in the end. The scheme collapsed. Wow. But if this could be the same Kim Il who's flying across to Dubai and partying with Hush Puppy, the money launderer he's going to work with. I mean, I'd love to meet the guy. He sounds absolutely incredible.
And he was apparently allowed to travel overseas without monitoring. I mean, the North Koreans normally go in groups of two or more, but it sounds like he might have gone to Dubai by himself for these partying experiences.
Exactly. So what I don't know, though, and just to sort of test my own premises on this, is yes, there's his character, Kim Il. I've been told Kim Il was working the sweet persona, was in touch with people via sweet persona. And I've heard that somebody from North Korea arrived in Dubai and met Hush Puppy in person. And it makes sense that that person would be sweet. But what we don't know is whether multiple people in North Korea were using the sweet identity. It could be Kim Il and others. It could be that Kim Il is the one guy. I don't know. And this is why, as you can tell, it's a work of investigation, this. I don't want to sort of say, yes, I've got the story. It's solid. Yeah. I've been told various things. I'm trying to jigsaw them together.
Yeah, that makes sense that perhaps the whole team is sweet in a way. I'm fascinated about the character of Ramon Abbas, the real identity behind Hush Puppy, how he was an Instagram influencer. And so in that way, in the way that he lived the consumption part of his life, he was kind of the exact opposite of North Korea, which likes to keep its consumption very private. But he's out there on Instagram showing, look, here's the watch I got, here's my new car, here's the hotel room, which is branded with a luxury label that I'm staying in. But on the other hand, he's kind of like North Korea in that he spent a lot of energy and resources in promoting himself and how successful he was, which North Korea also does too. So they've got some interesting contradictions and parallels, the two. It would have been interesting to see how well they work together.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, I mean, Hush Puppy, endlessly fascinating character, starts out in Nigeria. People who knew him back in those days say he was into fraud fairly early. Sadly, Nigeria has this reputation as being a fairly hefty center for fraud, and it seems that Hush Puppy was involved in that small minority of people in the country who do that. Moves to Malaysia and then moves to Dubai and sort of reinvents himself as this character, Hush Puppy. And as you say, his Instagram feed, he had 2 million followers on Instagram. He's attending lavish parties, he's modeling incredibly expensive clothes, he's staying in the Palazzo Versace, a Versace-themed hotel in Dubai. Now, that's all the public side. That's all what's above the surface. As you say, below the surface, he's making money out of cybercrime. Partly he's helping out the North Koreans. He's also running his own frauds. He's also assisting Big Boss in his money laundering. So Hushpuppi's got various different sources, if you like, of criminal income. Interestingly, the US government manages to work out who Big Boss is. They do this amazing raid in the, which is meant to be in the Bahamas, but then trips up and goes to Atlanta. So they manage to get hold of Big Boss. There's a whole story about how they manage to get Big Boss. They look on Big Boss's phone to see who he's working with. And of course, they come across Hushpuppi. Yeah. And you can imagine they sort of thought, well, let's Google it. And then you Google Hushpuppi, you come across the Instagram account. And the Secret Service must have been falling off their chairs, because not only is this guy laundering money for North Korea, they know exactly where he is and who he is and what he's doing, because he's on Instagram boasting about the money.
Yeah.
Secret Service then goes to the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and to Dubai to say, well, look, we need to arrest this guy. And the police sort of swoop in 2020 and arrest Hushpuppi, aka Ramon Abbas, in his hotel room. But it's interesting, you know, the point about North Korea and the parallels with Hushpuppi, I am interested about how this works within North Korea. And again, it's one of these things you probably never get the answer to. I mean, I don't think the apparatchiks at the top of the regime they probably know about Instagram, but the idea there's Instagram influencers and the idea that they were working with this Instagram influencer who is also a money launderer, it must have come completely out of left field to them. It's like, we were working with who, doing what? He was on Instagram. Can you explain Instagram to me? I'm intrigued by how the whole thing about DPRK hacking that constantly amazes me is that the internationally successful stories and globally significant stories they get involved with, they don't set out. I don't think the hackers in North Korea set out to be global news, but somehow they end up blithering into these situations.
Yeah.
The WannaCry cyber attack, the ransomware cyber attack, this Cosmos Bank thing with Hushpuppi, you know, they end up in these international sort of scandals, as it were. And I think I wonder whether the people at the top of or in senior levels at the regime in North Korea just hold their head in their hands and say, could you please stop doing
it? It is extraordinary how they ended up working with such a motley crew of people. You tell a story in your book that Abbas and Alamari didn't get nearly as much money as they'd been hoping for one of the money laundering gigs. I think that was the Bank of Valletta one. But the North Koreans were at the same time working with other launderers too, including in the UK. And you tell a story about how six people were arrested in London and Belfast in 2020 as a result of that Malta heist. Tell us how they were laundering money and how they got caught, because that's an interesting method.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So obviously the hackers break into Bank of Valletta. They're going to use SWIFT to transfer the money out. And a lot of that money went via SWIFT. But you're looking as a launderer to try and do things in multiple jurisdictions at once. The reason being, it makes it harder for police and law enforcement. They have to cooperate across borders. Yeah. It's harder for them. So the idea is some of the money's going across to Hong Kong, I think it was, from Bank of Valletta. But some of the money pitches up in the UK. We think about 800,000 of the money pitches up in the UK. And then the question is, well, we've transferred the money to UK sort of bank accounts, but how do we extricate it? Again, you need money launderers. And somehow the hackers who broke into Bank of Valletta, it seems, managed to find money laundering networks in the UK who could do this. The money gets withdrawn out of cash point, out of ATMs, some 800,000 or so. A lot of that money gets withdrawn and they spend it on Rolex watches and high-end cars, Audis and Jaguars. And you've got to realize this was during lockdown. So you've got to find a car dealer who's open and a watch dealer who's open to sort of go and spend your money on. The reason for that is if you can transfer the money into fast-moving expensive goods, in the case of Audis and Jags, literally fast-moving, you can move that money across borders a lot more easily and a lot less suspiciously. If I'm traveling from the UK to, say, France or Germany, and I've got £800,000 in my suitcase, if I get spotted, I'm going to have to come up with a plausible explanation as to why I've got that money, and it's not going to go well. If I drive my Audi with a Rolex on each wrist across the border, well, I've just transferred hundreds of thousands of pounds of stolen money. So investing into these kind of items is useful. And it's worth saying, actually, Hushpuppi, one of his laundering scams, not one of the North Korean ones, but he did exactly this. He used the stolen money to buy a Richard Mille watch in the US and had that couriered back to Dubai so he could wear it on his wrist. Of course, he's wearing stolen money, but it doesn't look like stolen money. It looks like an expensive watch, but it's funded by stolen funds. So these laundering techniques are sort of super fascinating.
That is interesting. Now, after both Ramon Abbas and Galeb Alamari were caught, tried, pleaded guilty and sent to prison, the North Koreans had to find an easier, less messy and more reliable way to launder money. So they turned to Bitcoin or to cryptocurrency. So tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the North Korean sort of experiments with cryptocurrency or alleged experiments with stealing it go date before all this Cosmos Bank stuff. They were already into this stuff. I mean, your listeners, I'm sure, will remember the WannaCry cyber attack, the ransomware attack back in 2017. Hundreds of thousands of computers around the world get their files scrambled and get charged a ransom to get the information back. As investigators looked into that, they found multiple links back to previous Lazarus Group or suspected Lazarus Group hacks. So the accusation, certainly by the UK government, US government, is that North Korea was behind that WannaCry ransomware attack. One of the weird things about that was, I mean, you've got to realize ransomware is phenomenally lucrative. It is the cash cow that has kept cybercrime alive, probably for more than 10 years. We're talking billions and billions of dollars.
Wow.
And yet WannaCry, they made less than $1 million. It was almost laughably bad, considering the impact, considering how fast that ransomware spread and the scale of it, to make less than $1 million.
And that's that's peanuts.
Yeah. I mean, for other ransomware gangs, they would almost find it laughably funny that you barely made enough money to buy a Lamborghini. That's the benchmark is, have you bought a Lambo? So it was intriguing. We couldn't understand, well, why would you do this? It made sense to a certain extent from a sort of PR perspective, like a black PR perspective, because if North Korea was behind the WannaCry ransomware attack, they have shown that they can take computers out across the world without even leaving their keyboards in Pyongyang. And it was, you know, there's a PR win to it. But actually the other aspect to this was the laundering aspect to it, because yes, they only made $1 million or so out of the attack, but they managed to take that money out, launder it through cryptocurrency channels, because the ransoms were paid in Bitcoin, of course. They can take that Bitcoin, laundered it effectively within about 48 hours, and it's gone. Now you compare that with what they did with Cosmos Bank and Bank of Valletta, getting people to cash points, getting people to buy Rolexes and Audis. There's a lot of physical stuff there, and you're losing profit every time you hire a money launderer. You know, those Audis and Jags, the person who bought them would have taken a cut, and the person who transferred the wallet, you're losing money all the way along. With crypto, you can charge the ransom, get the ransom digitally, launder it digitally in a matter of hours, and it's gone, and you get all of the money, or at least a lot more of the money as a result of this. So it makes it's no surprise really that North Korea, and in fairness a lot of other cybercrime gangs, got into crypto, because the economics just make a lot more sense. And so from 2017 onwards, the WannaCry ransomware attack, we just see more and more and more and more of these cryptocurrency attacks. The estimate I think at the moment is something like $3 billion worth of cryptocurrency stolen allegedly by North Korea, all of which, as well, your listeners will know, is helpful in feeding the nation's coffers, particularly under the sort of sanctions that it's under.
But the other thing that comes to mind with cryptocurrency is that because these ledgers are open, it can be possible to track the money at some stage and to find out where it's gone to. So if all the money that's taken from a particular bank in a heist end up in one account, then you know that's a pretty good sign that the thieves are behind that one. So how did North Koreans learn to layer and defuse the crypto more so to make it harder to track over time?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, all cryptocurrency transactions by their very nature are recorded publicly in a thing called the blockchain, where you can trace, in Bitcoin's case, you can trace transfers of Bitcoin. By the way, with the WannaCry ransomware job, that's exactly what I did. I thought, well, this is all public. When they take the money out of the wallets that the victims have paid into, we can trace it. So I did, using my computer, and I thought I had a brilliant lead. I thought basically I'd managed to find the guy who owned the wallet into which the vast majority of the money went. And we got very excited about this. I was working for Channel 4 News at the time. We decided we'd emailed the guy, we'd phoned him, we'd tried to get in touch, nothing, no results. So we decided we would go and knock at his door, which immediately throws up a whole bunch of health and safety and compliance risks, because is he going to answer the door with a gun, that kind of thing. So I think we had stab vests on. I think we actually had sort of body armor.
Wow.
Yeah, because you don't know who you're dealing with. The guy knew absolutely nothing about it at all, was an innocent victim. His wallet address had been hijacked by a bunch of fraudsters, and they were using it. And actually the wallet address belonged to a completely different entity. So anyway, that was my wild goose chase, trying to track down the money. But the principle still holds. You can use the internet to track Bitcoin transactions. And as you say, this is a big problem for anyone who steals cryptocurrency, including allegedly the North Korean hackers, the Lazarus Group. And so there's a whole industry, a thriving industry now, in terms of tracking these transactions, because if you can track it fast enough, if I steal, you know, Zacho, if you've got a cryptocurrency wallet or some Bitcoin, I steal it, you can see where it goes. And if you can contact the company that owns that wallet, if it's a Bitcoin exchange, for example, you can freeze the money. You can say to someone like Binance or Kraken, whoever, that money in that wallet is stolen from me. Here's the evidence of it. Please freeze the money. And eventually, possibly, they might, you know, recover the money. So there's a whole industry of people who, when these hacks happen, they're instantly tracking where the funds are going, trying to work out, have the funds ended up in a wallet that's owned by a company or an entity? Can we contact that entity or company and get them to freeze it? So the hackers, of course, are now in a cat and mouse game. They've got to sort of work out how they can get the money out and spirit it away. And the case, that this sort of arch case with this was a hack on a Vietnamese video game called Axie Infinity, in which the North Koreans were accused of breaking in and used really cutting edge technology to actually spirit this money away. It was an absolutely amazing case.
It was a lot of money. It was $625 million, I think, in all. And it was, very quickly done.
Yeah. Yeah, $625 million. That was how much the cryptocurrency was worth at the time. Obviously, to quote the thing, the value of cryptocurrency may go up or down and does quite heavily. But at the time, it was worth $625 million. Now, I will go out on a limb here. And I'm sort of, in a way, I'm goading people with this statement to see what people's reaction would be. I think that's a serious contender for the biggest theft of all time, which obviously sounds like it's a very big statement to make. But if you look at other big thefts, the Antwerp diamond heist, for example, is one people often talk to. That was 100 million. So it was nowhere near. The Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist, in which they stole artworks, is a contender. But the artworks were valued, I think, at 500 million. So again, So, you know, I'm putting it in the top 10. And what annoys me is when you go on the internet and you look, you know, biggest heist of all time, they talk about the great train robbery. It's a few million, nowhere near. Brinks Matt, a few tens of million, nowhere near. This Axie Infinity heist, the 625 million, is just nowhere. It's not listed anywhere. Huh. And even if my claim is wrong, it's not the biggest theft of all time. I'm pretty sure I'm on a safe bet to say it's the quickest, because to transfer out to the cryptocurrency, 600 million bucks of it, took 1 minute 55 seconds to make those transfers. Because, of course, it's all digital. You're not dealing with traditional banks where they have to move money via SWIFT and then someone has to take it out of the ATM. It's instant. You steal the crypto, it's gone in not 60 seconds in this case, but 120 seconds. So absolutely astonishing. But the problem, of course, then they've got is the investigators who work for this Vietnamese video game, that they can see exactly where the money's gone because, as you say, it's all recorded in a ledger. So the hackers now have to try and work out how they can vanish it. And what they turned to was a thing called a cryptocurrency mixer, which, as the name suggests, they take in cryptocurrency from lots of different people, mix it all together, and then they give everybody back their share, but into a fresh cryptocurrency wallet, which obviously for people listening sounds like it's a money laundering service. But actually, there's good reasons why you might want to use an anonymizing service in crypto. If you want to donate to Ukraine, for example, you know, if I donate directly from my personal Bitcoin wallet to the Ukrainian government's fund, there's a record of that online. Do I really want the Russian government to know I've done that? So you might want to use a mixer like this to anonymize donations. It's a good reason. But of course, for criminals, they can also use it for laundering money. And that's exactly what happened here. Of the 625 million, I think it was about 480 million went into a mixer called Tornado Cash, which did what Tornado Cash was built to do, mix the money and jettisoned it back out. And that money is, that, as far as we're aware, that money's just gone. It's been mixed, it's been laundered, and that half billion or so is just now at North Korea's disposal.
So it may actually be using that money without anybody being able to trace it. Is that right?
Exactly so. Now, interestingly, I've talked about the idea that they've used this mixer and they've used the mixer to launder the stolen cryptocurrency, and now that's gone. I've slightly elided over some facts there. Yes, the mixer anonymized the cryptocurrency. So there is cryptocurrency out there in the world, apparently stolen by North Korea, that it's impossible to trace back to the theft. But it's still in the form of cryptocurrency. And this is the interesting thing. If you're stealing crypto and you want to buy a house or a Lamborghini or nuclear weapons parts, at the moment, it's still quite difficult. It's getting more feasible. It's still difficult to actually use cryptocurrency to pay for stuff in the real world. So again, you've got this challenge of taking the cryptocurrency out and at some stage getting it into a bank account or into cash. So the mixing did a good job of laundering the money for North Korea, of divorcing it from the crime, but they've still now got the problem of, well, how do we get that crypto out into stuff we can use? And interestingly, there's been cybersecurity companies are seeing a bit of a decline in North Korean suspected cryptocurrency hacking activity. And one of the theories behind that is they've now got a glut of cryptocurrency that they've stolen that they need to somehow get out into the world, somehow convert into usable funds. And so they've eased off on the crypto hacking because there's no point hacking more crypto companies because we're already struggling to kind of process all of the stolen money that we've got. It's interesting, which again points to the fact that laundering is so essential in this process. Without laundering, you right. don't do the crime, because if you can't launder the money, there's no point doing it.
In a sense, I guess it's a bit like those thefts of famous artworks from museums where, you know, now you've got your Van Gogh or your Da Vinci, but you can't sell it because everyone yep. knows that it's stolen. So you know, you have to find that one guy who's that one person somewhere in the world who's willing to buy that off you, knowing that they can't show it to anybody else either. So they've got this cryptocurrency, which is mainly, I think, in two forms in the case of the Axie Infinity. Some of it was in Ether, or most mm-hmm. of it was in Ether. And the rest was in a, I think it was a Tether coin, a USDC.
USDT, yes.
That's pegged to the US dollar.
Exactly so. And that's sort of getting to the vagaries of cryptocurrency now. But obviously, as I've said, one of the problems with cryptocurrency has been the massive swings of value.
Right.
Currencies like Tether are meant to solve that because, as the name implies, it's tethered to the value of the US dollar. So it's a way of sort of hedging against these big swings in value. And obviously, for money launderers, these stable coins, as they're called, that are linked to the value of fiat currencies, are very useful because, as a money launderer, you know, if you're receiving money from a criminal gang and it's worth £1 million, the criminal gang is going to expect you to process £1 million. If the value of the cryptocurrency suddenly dips, it's going to be an awkward conversation to go back to a cartel drug dealer and say, oh, sorry, due to the value of cryptocurrency declining, right. I've only got 500,000 for you. So these stable coins are increasingly becoming really, really useful. And the trajectory, as I understand it, is to steal cryptocurrency in whatever form you can get, whatever crypto you can get, but to as quickly as possible get it into a stable coin. Yeah. So you know what you've got and you can launder it out. The downside, though, for these stable coins for hackers and criminals is that they're run by, unlike Bitcoin, things like Tether are sort of run by an entity, an organization that sort of controls it. So what they can sometimes do is freeze the assets. So in the way a free and easy thing like Bitcoin is better because nobody's in charge, nobody can freeze the funds, but Bitcoin goes up and down in value. Right. Tether's better because it doesn't go up and down in value, but there's an entity that can freeze it. So you've got swings and roundabouts, as we say in the UK, for criminals.
But Tornado Cash added a new feature to the standard crypto mixer because it is really the ultimate in DeFi or decentralized finance, that there is nobody in charge of it. And so I'm interested to tell us how did the US Treasury try to shut down or stop Tornado Cash, given that it doesn't have any centralized body or people behind it anymore?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's very well understood, Zacho. So what happens is Axie Infinity, this video game, gets robbed. It was technically a thing called the Ronin Bridge, which is a piece of software that the game relied on. Gets robbed for $625 million. Very quickly, the US government asserts that this is North Korean activity. And so this is a sanctioned country that's receiving money. So the US government ideally wants to stop that money getting to North Korea. That's the whole point. The problem is, because of Tornado Cash, the money's now seemingly rinsed. It's gone. So the next best bet really for the US government is to go after Tornado Cash. They've got what they see as solid evidence Tornado Cash was laundering money for the North Koreans. It all seems a pretty cut and dried case. Now, in the past, when law enforcement and the US government and police and so on have gone after these crypto mixers, they've often found somebody in charge of it. They can say, well, look, Mr. Such and Such, you set up, or indeed Mrs. Such and Such, a bit more rare, but you set up this crypto mixer. We are charging you with sanctions dodging. The problem with Tornado Cash was that the way it had been set up was using a thing called what's called a decentralized autonomous organization, which, as the name suggests, the idea is this is a company, an entity that runs without any leadership. So Tornado Cash was built by three developers. They launched the software. They then effectively sort of destroyed their passwords. So they said, look, we're not going to have anything. We can't even log in and run this thing anymore. It's going to be run by its users. If you use Tornado Cash, you will be given what's called a token, a sort of little cryptocurrency token, and you get to vote. So if somebody says, hey, I think Tornado Cash should do this, the users can vote on whether that change should happen. And if the vote gets won, the change automatically happens. It's a way of creating an organization that has no one at the heart, no one at the center, and therefore has no one for law enforcement to go after. So when the US government goes to Tornado Cash, they realize, well, there doesn't seem to be anybody in charge of this thing.
Yeah.
But what do we do? Well, what they did was what the US government is increasingly doing around cybercrime, which is sanctions. They said, look, Tornado Cash laundered money for the North Koreans as far as we're concerned. We are sanctioning this company. It doesn't shut it down. You can still use Tornado Cash. If you want to, you can use Tornado Cash to hide your cryptocurrency and to anonymize it. But if you're in the US and you do that, you are potentially sanctions dodging because you're using an entity that's been sanctioned, that's breached sanctions according to the US government. So it's a way of freezing out Tornado Cash. You can't kill it because there's nobody in charge of it to switch the off button, right? Switch the button off, but you can sanction it and you can freeze it out, which is kind of what the US did after 9/11. You know, they had this idea of good banks and bad banks. You know, if you're a bad bank, we can't stop you existing, but you will never trade with anyone in the US.
Right.
Doing a similar sort of thing. However, there's two things about this, two fascinating sort of postscripts. Number one, it turns out that certainly according to the US authorities, the people who set up Tornado Cash and claimed to take their hands off the machine did no such thing. The US government claims that the developers still ran the thing and they are now prosecuting them. One guy in the US has been arrested. One guy in Russia has been indicted by the US. And the third chap in Holland has also been arrested. And they're all awaiting trial. So we're going to see what happens with that.
Wow.
So this idea of, oh, it was a leaderless organization, the law enforcement aren't buying that. And we'll see where the case goes. Obviously, the defendants deny these charges. The second thing that happened was really interesting was the tech community, the crypto community, looked at what happened with Tornado Cash and said, well, you can't do that. You can't sanction a piece of computer code. If somebody stabs somebody with a knife, you don't prosecute the knife manufacturer. You prosecute the person who did the stabbing. So the argument is that the US government, by sanctioning Tornado Cash, has breached its powers, is overreaching, is threatening freedom of speech. And if you're a coder, a techie, and you build code, are you now responsible for everybody who uses your code, no matter who they are, where they are? So the tech community is pushed back and actually suing the US government on this, saying, look, you can't sue Tornado Cash. And so again, just going back to this point, you know, if it is North Korea behind this hack, they've ended up in the middle of this globally significant freedom of speech, libertarian crypto law enforcement story. And again, I don't think they had any idea that was going to happen. They end up in these bizarre, globally significant stories.
Wow. That is, and of course, there's much more detail to be found in your book there called Rinsed. Just in preparing for this podcast, I did a bit of a Google News search to look through stories from the last couple of weeks. So here are some headlines that I've seen just in the last month. Japan warns of malicious PyPI packages created by North Korean hackers. And the PyPI is PYPI, stands for Python Package Index. North Korean hackers exploit Windows zero-day flaw. Another one, FBI identifies 6 Bitcoin wallets related to Lazarus hacker group from North Korea. Another one, Lazarus exploits typos to peddle malware. Another one, total crypto laundered in 2023 drops 29.5% year on year, but North Korean linked hackers are finding new tactics. And that's according to a report by Chainalysis. So what kind of platforms and tools have North Korean hackers moved on to for their next trick?
Well, they are still, as far as I'm aware, they're still exploiting cryptocurrency quite a lot. The headline you pointed to there about cryptocurrency theft going down, again, that Axie Infinity was a high tide mark. You know, it skewed the figures for 2022, which is when it happened. So the subsequent year has been lower. But again, there's this idea that it's lower because North Korea's hackers are alleged to be struggling to launder the money. So they've eased back a bit from the crypto thefts. Is one possible explanation. But what's absolutely remarkable, there was a report from, I think it was a company called TRM Labs, who are a cryptocurrency tracing firm, talking about the ways that North Korea's hackers are suspected of using all of these different new cryptocurrency tools. So we've talked about devolved finance and DAOs and mixers like Tornado Cash. There were also coin swap services where effectively it's a similar thing. You're putting cryptocurrency in, you're getting cryptocurrency out that's swapped for you from somebody. There are what are called cross-chain bridges, where if you're transferring Bitcoin, it'll be on the Bitcoin blockchain. If you're transferring Ethereum, it'll be on the Ethereum blockchain. To swap between the two, you use a cross-chain bridge. Well, those are now a target for hacking, but they're also being used to launder money. What amazes me about this is, look, we're pushing up now against the limits of my knowledge of cryptocurrency. I mean, this stuff is incredibly complicated and really arcane. And yet, if the accusations are right, North Korean hackers are so across this stuff. that they are at the absolute cutting edge of finance. They're also exposed, of course, to market movements. So they're going to have to look at the exchange rates of different currencies and how right. they can move. The financial engineering and the financial plumbing they're involved in is really, really extreme, sharp end stuff. I mean, you know, there were people at Deutsche Bank and JP Morgan who would not understand any of this stuff. It's amazing, again, for a country that is, you know, nominally socialist, they're involved in a great deal of financial chicanery. I just find it remarkable. Again, I'd just love to meet these guys and talk about how they work. Won't happen, of course, but fascinating people and so bright. I mean, to get their head around this stuff is really, really difficult. And they obviously understand it very, very, very well.
Would it make sense for a lot of these hackers to be North Korean, but working outside North Korea, say in a lab set up in China or another friendly country, perhaps Russia, maybe even parts of India?
Yeah, it's interesting. Certainly through the Lazarus Heist, through the podcast and so on that I did with Gene and a bit through the book, we've looked at this kind of movement of North Korean hackers. China obviously being a key territory, traditionally a supporter, usually a supporter, I suppose you could broadly say, of North Korea. Obviously, the other advantage is China has a huge amount of internet users, whereas North Korea doesn't have very many. And so the amount of internet traffic coming out of North Korea is smaller and more easily surveilled by international companies, by North Korea's sort of opponents, as it were. China, a lot more traffic to hide in. So the traditional sense has been moving people across to China. The Russia point is interesting. We've obviously seen moves being made between Russia and North Korea, which again is fascinating because the grand history as well, you'll know, of North Korea, this balancing of Chinese and Russian influence in North Korea and sometimes playing off against each other, the three-way thing. That move towards Russia as a result of its reinvasion of Ukraine from North Korea was interesting. So again, you know, is there more activity going on? Are North Korean hackers moving more into Russia? One thing I do wonder is about whether Russia has been talking to North Korea. Obviously, there's talks about weapons, as far as we know, and support and so on. But also, North Korea has been under international financial sanctions for a long time and yet has managed to survive. I wonder whether one of the conversations being had between Russia and North Korea is, well, how do you make that work? Because Russia obviously is now under extreme international financial sanctions. Again, I can't imagine that there won't be somebody within the Russian regime who's talking to somebody in the North Korean side saying, how do you guys get around that? What systems do you use? And I wonder whether we're going to start to see more collaboration. We're going to start to see signs and traces in cryptocurrency of sort of collaboration between them. But yeah, to answer your question, it does make sense that the hackers would work overseas simply because it's easier to sort of disappear into the crowd. And also you absorb, it's quite hard, I think, within North Korea to absorb what's going on in the world in terms of what's going on in crypto. It's easier if you've got access to the open internet and you're in a country somewhere where there's, you know, a lot of knowledge that you can absorb about how these systems are working. It's easy to become a more effective hacker, I think, in that context.
Well, my last question for you, Jeff, is what are you watching now from North Korea? What do you predict for the next year, for the rest of 2024?
It's going to be interesting. I think there's going to be more of a push into these sort of very arcane cryptocurrency tools. I think that the industry is going to react by that by coming up with lots more sort of tracing capability that it can use. I think that you're going to see the US government pushing ahead again with these sanctions. Wherever they see alleged North Korean cryptocurrency activity popping up, they're going to be quick in there with the sanctions, and the sanctions are going to become the main tool. My worry, though, with sanctions is part of me thinks, you know, countries like Russia, for example, and North Korea will just pull all of the levers, put them under incredibly strict sanctions, freeze them out, hit every stop button that you can. The problem with that is you've got to give countries an ability to work their way out of sanctions. And if you've used all of the tools in your toolbox and they do something else that's bad, what are you going to say to them? You know, are we going to sanction you? Oh, but we haven't got any more sanctions. So you run out of options. You know, you've always got to leave yourself options so that you can escalate, but also gives the other side the opportunity to sort of de-escalate. So I do have slight concern about where the sort of sanctions territory is going in there. But yeah, it's going to be getting more into this arcane crypto stuff. And what worries me about that is, and this applies to suspected North Korean hacking as well as other cybercrime, is I think the public struggle still to understand crypto. And I think there's a section of the public who perhaps rightly think crypto is a speculative game for rich lunatics, basically, or people who, you know, want to lose all of their money. They don't think it's real money. And that's, again, this is what annoys me about this Axie Infinity attack, is it's one of the biggest thefts of all time. It's certainly the quickest.
Yeah.
And yet it hasn't really gone, and it's not been absorbed. And I think it's because the public think crypto doesn't count, it doesn't matter. Well, if it's half a billion of crypto, it's still half a billion dollars. It may be in the form of crypto, but it still matters. And so my worry is, as the hackers, North Korea included, get more and more into these arcane financial systems, our ability, my ability as a journalist to interest the public in it and explain it to the public and get them to care and think it really matters, I worry is going to get harder. But that's a job for me and people like me and you to do in the future.
Now, I know that you feel frustrated, but imagine how frustrated the people who stole all that money in 2 minutes must be. They can't hire a PR firm and trumpet it to the world and let everyone know what they've done, you know?
Yeah, indeed.
Wow. Well, it's been great talking to you again, Jeff, and congratulations on your new book, Rinsed. When's that coming out?
June 13th.
Okay, so we're a couple of months ahead, so people can get their pre-orders in now. People can find you online at jeffwhite.tech. And that's Jeff with a G-E-O rather than a J-E, or on Twitter at JeffWhite247.
Correct. Lovely.
Great. Thanks very much for coming on the show, and good luck with it all. Keep an eye on it.
Been a pleasure. Thank you. Good to speak to you.
Thank you. Likewise. All right.
Keeping up with South Korea's fast-paced developments just got easier. Welcome to the Korea Pro podcast, your weekly briefing on the stories that matter. Hosts Jongmin Kim and John Lee dissect topics from diplomacy to technology, ensuring you're always informed. Our episodes are a must for professionals in and out of Seoul. Subscribe on your preferred platform and elevate your understanding of Korean affairs. Korea Pro Podcast, where clarity meets depth. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our podcast episode for today. Our thanks go to Brian Betts and Alana Hill for facilitating this episode, and to our post-recording producer genius, Gabby Magnuson, who cuts out all the extraneous noises, awkward silences, bodily functions, and fixes the audio levels. Thank you, and listen again next time.